Welcome to Opera Talks. With me today is Matthew Hanscom, who is singing Marcello. La Boheme will open at the California Theater on Saturday, April 15, for a run of six performances, closing Sunday, April 30. Matt will sing Marcello at all six performances. Matt, by my reckoning, you have performed 11 roles for Opera San Jose over the past 3 years, and Marcello will make your 12th. These range from Rigoletto to Papageno and include the world premiere of Where Angels Fear to Tread, in which you sang the principal role, Gino Carella, and most recently, you sang Lieutenant Gordon in Silent Night. What are some of the other roles you've performed here that you think might be of help in the future?
At the beginning of this season, Enrico in Lucia di Lammermoor, a great role for my voice specifically, and one I've done a couple times now, performed a lot, so it's useful every single season, which is not always the case with a world premiere or some brand new modern music, and that's not any knock against modern music, but it's just a fact that, you know, the repertory dictates that you have to perform a lot of the old war horses, and so this is a very good one, as is La Boheme that we're about to do. So from a singer's perspective, some of those types of shows are very, very useful.
I was surprised to hear that this is your first Marcello. It seems such a natural for you.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun, and this is my third production of La Boheme. The previous two I sang Schaunard, and the vocal demands of both roles, they're the same, really, written for the same kind of baritone. And, you could jump into either one. And really, that would be kind of fun going back and forth, except that it would get confusing when all of the guys are talking over each other. But Schaunard is a lot of fun, though, too. He's full of energy. It's sort of his arc of his character is a little more, it's less weighty. It's kind of, until the end where it hits everyone, when Mimi finally dies. But as you go through the opera, he's more just having a good time with Colline, so that can be a fun rehearsal period and production period as well. But Marcello is, one of the, as far as Puccini baritones go, probably top three for sure. And
You've done Scarpia also here.
Oh, Scarpia is fantastic. I mean, we could have talked about Scarpia previously too, as far as things that are useful. Of course, Tosca's performed all the time. The problem with Scarpia is that all baritones want to do Scarpia all the time, and so there aren't a lot. Even though there are many productions, it's just that the people all at the top are going to gobble up this role because everybody wants to do these all the time.
Scarpio and Iago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Rigoletto too. So, having the opportunity to have done some of that stuff here, invaluable for the long term, but also able to make a check mark on your sort of bucket list, early on in your career, which I'm very thankful for.
Yeah, and then guess what? Once you've got them on your bucket list, and now they're that means that there could be future performances, because it's so strange. Companies will only hire people who have already sung those roles.
They often will. It's a to get your foot in the door. Even now, when my manager will call me, they'll ask, all of a sudden we have this role. Somebody dropped out. Do you know it? And if you don't know it, then you're not under consideration. But if you know it, then you're in, or at least in the conversation. Because, if you have to jump in at a late period, no matter how good a musician you are, I could probably learn an opera. If you gave me 3 days, I could, honestly, if I were going to hit it as hard as I could all day, every day, you could give me 3 days and I'd be fine. I mean, I wouldn't be happy, but I would be on the edge of my seat, but it could be done. When they're trying to cast someone last minute like that, why take the risk, especially if they're calling around looking for whoever they want, if it's an emergency.
Precisely. They don't take that risk because so many singers, even after they've sung a role many times, still don't really know it.
Yeah. So, and I mean, these are difficult pieces, but yes, that is the case.
Yeah. Sometimes it's good. That's how Irene actually made her introduction to the opera world. She was hired at Oldenburg and her first role was Eboli. And she was there in her first week and they said, okay, well, on Monday, report to rehearsal for Dorabella.
There you go. Okay, well, that's a little different. And sometimes, opportunity knocks like that. And if you've had a chance to prepare yourself in a setting, like a resident setting like we have here, you know, you're going to be much better equipped to sort of answer the call when, you know, opportunity knocks, like I say.
So this La Boheme thing, this is, La Boheme has become the most performed opera in this country.
And I understand why. Honestly, it's probably, if it's not La Boheme, it should probably be Tosca or maybe Madame Butterfly. Is, you know, if you've never been to the opera before, it should probably be one of these operas.
Because I think it's the very best first opera.
It really is, because it's funny for, you know, more or less kind of three acts. You know, it gets a little serious in act three, but there's still some kind of that quartet brings it back down to earth to some extent. But three acts are kind of, you know, frivolous enough and a lot of fun and jokes and energy.
And most of the fourth act.
And yeah, and a lot of the fourth act until all of a sudden you're weeping uncontrollably. And so then you've experienced everything you need to from the theater that night. And so it's very effective in that way.
I have a suspicion that there are a lot of operas about the boy and the girl, right?
Oh, so almost all of them.
Basically every opera is about the boy and the girl.
Exactly.
But I think this opera is about more than that. I think this opera is about actual friendship.
No doubt about it. Of course.
These guys, they help each other and they care about each other. And it's a real camaraderie. And I think that was mostly drawn. Okay, Murger, Saint de la Vie de Bohème. Of course, that's what he's describing. But if you read that book, it's, you know, just a lot of little episodes about things that went on in their lives.
Exactly.
The lives of these Bohemian people who knew each other. It's not moving. It's not wonderful. It's just not. It was of wild interest at the time because everybody wanted a glimpse into Bohemian life. It's like in the 60s, people wanted to know what the really hippies were really doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there was some interest in what the beatniks were doing.
Sure.
Because there are a lot of movies and plays about beatniks, so people must have been interested. But I think that what Puccini, Illica, and Giacosa were able to pull off was to pull these people together and make them into human beings who are a little better than we are.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, the way that those original serials were written, you know, published piece by piece,
right,
in the periodical, doesn't probably, that way of storytelling probably doesn't lend itself to, you know, drawing a really long arc that, you know, is going to give you the huge payoff at the end. Like, each one had to be its own self-contained little story.
Little payoff every single time.
Yeah, so you never really get that full payoff that we're able to get with the opera. And you know, and I think they turned it into a stage play as well. I don't know. I haven't seen the stage play. I've read the novel, too.
It's just like Tosca was a stage play, and that's gone the way of all flesh. Many things were plays. First, Traviata was La Dama Camelia,
right,
and that went away, and they don't work. You try to revive them, and they don't work. We had this idea of San Jose Rep and Opera San Jose doing the same thing in the same season, so people could go see the play, then come see the opera. But when we looked at those, the plays really weren't viable.
If you have the right material, you know, like Of Mice and Men, something like that, where it's a very potent play,
or any of the Shakespeare's.
Oh, sure, and any of that. So, yeah, in that way, that would be a very interesting season. But, you know, some of these things that have been lost to time, there's a reason why they drop out.
Always wanted to do an all-Shakespeare season.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Yeah, I several companies are kind of doing that, but there are companies that have, like, a two-opera season, so it's a little less ambitious where they just do
it. I mean, there are so many.
Yeah, they're lying. Many of them are by Verdi, so that would be amazing. I would love that.
And there's some French ones in there too. We have Hamlet from the French.
Sure.
But yeah, they're very strong. And Britain's Midsummer Night's Dream. There's some. One could do a whole Shakespeare season, but there are many members of the public who say they don't like Shakespeare because it's too hard to follow the language.
Oh well.
And it might be difficult to market an all Shakespeare season.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you find yourself not able to follow along with a Shakespeare, reading through a Shakespeare, you know, when it comes into the Italian, you're reading the supertitles. That's been the supertitle is always.
There've been many filters between Shakespeare and you.
They've been filtered down, so your understanding will be there. So, I think they would find it. They may even find it more accessible than just sitting and reading the plays themselves.
I'm going to London this year on Christmas Day.
Oh, there you go.
And the Royal Shakespeare is going to be performing in London then, and I could see four different Shakespeare plays. Oh. I know I'm going to go see Julius Caesar, but Antony and Cleopatra is going to be up there, Titus Andronicus is going to be up there, and something else. So I'm thinking about boning up.
There you go. Perfect. That sounds like a great vacation.
This is a crazy trip. It's one of these tours that, you know, I occasionally get invited on tours.
Opera tour.
Yeah.
Ah, very good.
Except it's not opera.
Mm. Okay.
Because it was proposed to me that we go on an opera tour in December, and I said, I don't want to go on an opera tour. I'll just have been on one in Santa Fe. I'll be in Santa Fe for 2 weeks this summer watching operas, right? And I thought, I don't want to go on an opera tour. And she said, well, how about we just go to museums and stuff like that? And I said, well, could we see some theater? I'd love to see some theater in England. So
will you be talking about them then too, or?
Yes, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe stepping maybe just a one side step out of your comfort zone, but it'll be fantastic, I'm sure.
Well, it does mean I'm going to have to be reading some plays.
No, well,
and some
course.
Lives of playwrights, which will be fun for me because that's new territory.
Right.
So you're working with a great group of kids. I think the resident company this year has been...
Oh, wonderful.
Just a terrific... Last year, too, but this year, there's something special.
Yeah.
About these, I mean, Colin and Brian, and obviously Kirk is. I think Kirk is one of the most technically accomplished singers I've ever.
Oh, fantastic! And you'd know that if you ever get into hopefully Kirk listens, so he would. If you ever get into a talk about technique with Kirk, you'll know immediately that he is technically accomplished. Well, a lot of tenors are that way, but Kirk especially.
Well, he never scares you.
No,
I mean, so many tenors go up into the top, and you're just a little. Oh, is this gonna go?
And by the end of the night, right?
And never for him. No. And especially when I went to him to say, okay, we're doing Lucia Lammermoor, and would you object if we did the Wolfcrag scene? He said, no, it's a great scene.
Right.
He didn't think for an instant,
right.
Oh, yeah, no, that's going to tire me out. I won't be able to get through my double aria at the end. No, oh, no, that's a great scene. Why would you cut that?
Right.
For the tenor.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because we don't want to cut the two arias in the last scene. We want that whole big double thing going. And he just sailed through it.
Fantastic. Yep. I mean, this is a luxury casting at its finest. I mean, I think you can almost, except that we don't have a mezzo, you could cast anything with the people that we have here right now. It's not like, you know, international, like Jonas Kaufman type, but we could do a fantastic regional job here with anybody that we have here right now.
And audiences are really responding to that, by the way.
I'm glad.
They're really getting it.
Good.
They're coming to me. I'm getting special extra financial donations.
Perfect.
People come to see an opera and then they just send checks.
All right. Well, I'll look for my cut in the mail.
Yeah. There you go. It's very, very surprising.
Good.
That isn't usually the case. And next year, we're not doing any contemporary work, nothing 20 or 21st century.
Okay.
And that was, you know, not my hope and goal. I've always wanted to sing one new thing every year.
It would be nice.
25% of our rep, one new thing every year. And so far, for 3 years, I've done it. But next year, I couldn't find anything.
Right. And it's a tough push to get all those ticket sales in, I would assume, for something new that people aren't familiar with.
And well, and I guess the subscription renewals kind of testify to that because we're well ahead of last year at this time with new subscriptions. And one lady did send a check just so that I would call her to thank her.
There you go.
Because she knows I always do that, right? And just so that she could say, I sent that because there's no contemporary opera.
Oh, there you go. Yep. Some people want to hear all that great old stuff, the stuff that they know and that they can hum along to and leave the theater with, you know, three different melodies that, you know, you could hear on the radio conceivably. But other people, you know, want to see something new. So I think it's important to explore those new horizons as well.
I was once on one of these tours to New York, and it was a group of about 24, and we were not staying close to the Met. We were staying a little bit farther uptown.
Okay.
So there was a bus. So we were walking out of, I believe it was Rigoletto. And by the way, it was a dog of a production. So we were walking out, and these two people, husband and wife, were standing by the door of the bus. And as I approached, the wife said, I hated that opera. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And I was about to do a little explanation of, I didn't like it much either.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a chance because she instantly said, that's the last time I go see an opera that I haven't seen before.
Okay.
And that caught me a little off guard. He said, you know,
you might only have like three operas that you can ever go see then for a lot of people.
That's a little like saying that's the last book I ever read that I haven't already read.
Yeah, that's
and
rough.
She said, yeah. And her husband said, oh. But the art form is dead, obviously. If you quit producing new work, the art form has died. And who wants that?
And it's actually right at this moment in history, some amazing things coming out.
It's changed.
Honestly, every year, and a lot of it is from initiatives, you know, by places like the Minnesota Opera that I'm, you know, I'm proud of. I haven't worked there, but you know, it's where I first saw my first opera. It's where I grew up, and so I do feel, you know, kind of proud that they have this initiative to always.
They're doing between one and two world premieres every season.
Yeah, and they win prizes every year. And I mean, the press on them is insane.
Yeah, Silent Night, which we just did.
Exactly.
That's one of the best operas I've ever seen in my life anywhere, period.
I was so thankful that they had it on PBS to stream ahead of time, because what a production. And I had so many friends in it, too, so I got to let them know that they did a good job.
Yeah, and now you're Lieutenant Gordon.
Yeah. Hey, Lieutenant Gordon is fantastic. I know of like three companies that are doing this next year, so hey, I know that part.
And you could easily step in to a few others.
I know, yeah. That's the great part about, you know, things like Billy Budd and Silent Night, where, I mean, the male cast is just massive, and particularly for low voice. So.
And no role is very long.
No, right.
And if you've been in the show, you've done it with people, you've rehearsed it for weeks on end.
Precisely.
It would take very little time to put something like that right in your throat.
Right. And a lot of the battle on a new piece of theater, of opera specifically, is knowing what's going on, particularly when it's in a different language. Like, who is this? Who am I disguised as right now? Who's this false letter for? Like, that's not always readily apparent. So if you've been through that process, talked it through with the director, built it in your body, those things are already there. And, you know, the process of learning notes, if you're an accomplished musician like we are at this point in our careers and our schooling, that can be done.
Are you the right voice for Horstmeier?
You
are?
Yeah, it does. Honestly, that's the highest. Horstmeier sings so high. Yeah, when he talks about the trees with the tinsel, it's super high. Yeah, I think he has an A. I can't remember, but and it does. It sits a little lower than the other roles.
But then it pops up to the top.
Right. And it's mostly middle voice, just like everything is. So, for sure, it could be done.
That's a great role.
Oh, that's a great role.
Horstmeier.
I think the moment at the end with that, where he points the gun and he's like, stop, halt, and they don't stop. And then he's like, and then he fires it up in the air. Ooh. If you pull off that with the lighting and the right sound effect and all of the right intensity, that's a scary moment.
Our audiences. One lady... No, it wasn't that. It was the death of Ponchelle.
Oh, well, the death of Ponchelle is the crux of the whole thing.
It was one night when a lady literally screamed and Ponchelle was shot.
Right.
She literally screamed.
Yes.
Now, this show drags you with it.
Oh, yeah.
You can't get out of this show. It drags you right in.
Oh, well, the death of Ponchelle is amazing just because, you know, they shoot this soldier and you don't know who it is until his clock rings and... All of a sudden, tears, and you just can't help it.
Except that one night, when he turned around, you saw his face.
Oh, no, well, that's just...
When he got shot, the lady screamed, because it was Ponchelle.
Oh, okay,
right?
I see.
So, yeah, otherwise you find that it's a little more gentle.
Right.
It after he's been shot, and you hear the clock go off.
You go,
oh, my God, that was Ponchelle. That's not the same thing as having the guy aim his gun and fire it.
Right, no.
At the guy who is your hero. I mean,
nope.
Ponchelle. And you know, I only wanted to bring that opera if Brian James Meyer could sing Ponchelle.
Oh yeah.
He's the
tailor made for him.
Only person in the world I wanted to have in that role.
Yeah.
And when I called him up to offer it to him, he said, but I prepared Eau de Berre.
Oh, okay.
I said,
well,
you don't want to sing Eau de Berre. You want to sing Ponchelle. You go look at that broadcast.
Right.
And you come back to me after
that. Well, it's a little longer role. You get an aria. But as far as, you know, who the people leave remembering, it is Ponchelle. Because he has all the funny lines and the amazing death scene. So.
Yeah, and he's genuinely, he's a funny guy.
Exactly.
And such a warm heart, you know. Well, what's... Okay, you and Rodolfo. I just switched gears big time.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think I heard the transmission just fall out of the car. You and Rodolfo, that's a big friendship. And you're having trouble. You're Bohemians, and you ain't got no money.
Yeah, right.
So you're Bohemians who are not really necessarily very successful artists.
No, right. Well, you know, a lot of us are putting our ends together to see what we can do, even at this point in history. So, yeah, but it's a friendship that I see in my own life. I don't think it's that different than, you know, than things that relationships we as people still have today. I mean, they live together. It's like being in the frat house with your guys.
Yeah, exactly.
It's something that, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with from my tenure at university. But and the thing is that when you're living with those guys, you can spend every moment of your life with them, and you can have sort of a heartbreak inside of you, things on your mind, and you don't always let it out to those people. Even though these are your best friends, you don't want to necessarily let it loose to them that, you know, something's on your mind, something's eating at you. You have, you know, there's a girl that, you know, broke up with you, and it's hurting your soul that she's not with you anymore. Like in the fourth act with the duet between Rodolfo and Marcello, you know, how are they dealing with their pain? They're razzing each other about each other's misfortunes.
Yeah. Well, they're guys.
Exactly, and that's the way I handle my problems still to this day. So yeah, it seems perfectly healthy.
I think that's how guys do it. Yeah. I don't tell anybody when I'm having an issue.
No.
Frankly, I don't usually know I'm having an issue until it's over.
Right.
Oh, I was having an issue. I don't think we're all that in touch. A lot of guys are just not all that in touch with themselves, and certainly not with each other. But, you know, I messed with this one when I requested that we change the period for La Boheme to 1918 after the war.
Right.
Which was probably going to confuse a lot of people. And I apologize if you've heard the podcast with Schaunard and Colline, because I explained it then, but many have not heard that. So when I realized that I was going to have the exact same people in La Boheme who had just performed Silent Night, including my stage director and my conductor, said, oh, wow, they're just back from the war. So 1914, Silent Night opens on the first Christmas of the Great War, and La Boheme also opens on Christmas, the same day, Christmas Eve. I said, well, why not have it Christmas Eve of 1918? That would be wonderful. So I went to my costume director, said, Alyssa, we don't have very many clothes from 1918, do we? She said, oh, about six.
Six.
I said, well, I guess that won't work, because I would surely love to do this in 1918. And some people were coming through, and they were asking me to tell them the stories of the operas. And when I got to La Boheme, La Vie, the last one of the season, I said, and having just talked about Silent Night, I said, and if I had my druthers, I would have La Boheme the first Christmas after the war in 1918, but of course can't do that because we don't have the costumes. And a woman who was there with the tour stayed afterwards and said, Larry, I'd like to help with the costumes. And I thought because she has connections in costume shops, and I thought she was saying that she would like to help me look for them, because I mentioned, oh, if we could rent them from places, we would do that, but of course we can't. And she said, no, I don't mean that. I mean, I'd like to pay for a new set of costumes.
Very cool.
So all of a sudden, we have La Boheme in 1918.
Beautiful. Musetta's stuff, particularly.
Yeah. It's Downton Abbey clothes.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, it's all very cool. And
very
cool.
And
who was in Paris? Nijinsky, Pavlova, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, Picasso, Braque. I mean, it was the making of the 20th century was happening in Paris between those wars.
Right, right.
And this is the springboard, 1918, the year the war was over. That's the springboard of the 20th century. And I just thought, oh, this is the most glamorous, exciting, scintillating period in Western culture. I mean, when did we ever have a decade like that? You have to go for a pretty long time to get that much stuff going. I mean,
yeah.
the years when Haydn, Mozart, Schubert, and Beethoven were alive and working. But that's not a decade. That's 30, 40
right.
years.
A generation.
Yeah, two generations, yeah. So it's kind of unique to have it all collapsed into a tiny little place like that. So I thought, well, that would Café Momus would be a great thing to have all these people in the crowd. So we're doing it. We're changing that. So that makes a different kind of camaraderie because these guys are in the trenches together.
Yeah.
And that causes a different kind of closeness than just frat houses.
Sure. Yeah, it's of course.
A greater depth. And I thought, I like that because to me, what this opera is about more than falling in love is loving your friends.
Yes. And sort of the reality of what's out there in life. You know, most of the opera is spent very innocently, you know, doing your art and enjoying wine and food until, you know, real life does hit us from time to time. And then when real life hits you, you find yourself, you know, a lot of the time at a hospital, you know, with nothing that you can do, with your hands tied and
helpless.
Just, yeah. Yep. And it's a very sad thing. I've been there myself, and probably most of us that are listening have. And if you think about how that made you feel, that's what we're going for in this piece.
That's why this is seemingly one of the greatest masterpieces. Because it leads us into that world without slapping us in the face with it.
Right.
We're just present to see some people having a great time who love each other. And then when they discover life, because they're so young.
Yeah.
That's another cool thing about this cast. Everybody is so young.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just lovely young people. The whole room is filled with lovely young people. And that really helps the work have verisimilitude. You can believe that these people are 25 because guess what? They're 25.
Approximately. About.
Oh, you're not 25. You have a new baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. An 8-month old baby, a baby girl, Brooklyn. And my son is 3.5. So, yep. We're on to sort of like a different place in life, in my own life, than some of these bohemians. Kind of that next chapter, but...
Well, you're a very responsible man.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, I do have responsibilities now.
Yeah, I can't imagine you drinking absinthe and flirting with the coquettes.
Oh, I can't either. I would never have been able to do things like that.
Yeah, you're just not the type.
No.
Nor am I. I think those of us who go into this art form are serious-minded.
Yeah.
It's just too demanding.
I mean, I just and serious-minded, but I take the work that I do seriously. I want to always project a good product out there. You know, I love telling jokes. Rehearsal periods are arguably like the most fun thing about this because opera singers are fantastic people. They're all very fun. You know, there's a handful of crazy and kind of a handful of, you know, a-holes, for lack of a better word. But for the most part, these are the people that you would like to have with you at dinner. These are the people you want to have over for drinks after. And, you know, it's a lot of fun that way.
Well, Opera San Jose doesn't deal with divas.
No.
We never have.
We haven't. Not in my time here. 3 years at least.
Well, we've had a couple who wanted to be. But they're not here anymore.
No.
It's a... It is true that in a resident company, you have to create an environment and you have to pay attention to who's in it because one person who is sour on life can make everybody's life less pleasant. And that's something that I have grown accustomed to over 30-some years of working in a resident company. I've gotten sensitive to the fact that you do have to pay attention to who you're bringing into the group. And we kind of talk to folks and get to know them before we offer agreements.
Right.
And if it's not works, then it's a 1-year contract and they won't spoil it for the next year.
Yeah. So. The fact is that in any profession, from speaking for myself, life is too short to be working with people that aren't there with you, that don't want to do this work, especially in the arts, because it's a little bit on the brink. You know what I mean? And if you're not here to do the work, if you don't care about doing the work right, for one thing, it's the next time we do an opera, could be the last. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's way too, like, anytime an opera is produced, there's probably 10 people in the audience that will never go again. And there's nothing you can do about that. It could be the best opera that has ever been on the stage. And if you're not 100% committed to putting the best opera out there, that number goes up and up and up and up and up, and then pretty soon there's no one left going. And so we just don't have a, we don't have the luxury of being able to put up with people who aren't all in.
Yeah, who don't do the work.
Yeah.
That's why the stage directors that I try to bring here, I try to understand as much about them as I can before the director comes. It's not always possible. Sometimes it's a sudden change and you don't have a choice. You've got to bring who's available.
Sure, it could be a different face at an interview or as opposed to working. But
by and large, I think we've had such great luck over the past 3 years.
Yeah.
With very good stage directors.
Fantastic.
Lillian Groag is divine, and Brad Dalton is a miracle, and Michael Schell is the new discovery for me. And
no, he's great.
For Italian Girl, he came and did such a wonderful job.
Yes.
And we had long talks. We haven't had many talks for this opera. It's for Silent Night. It was all too busy, and this opera also. Now I'm all too busy during Bohème, when Michael would have probably a little more free time, but I don't have the time.
Well, we had a bit of a shortened rehearsal period on this one because of schedules and whatnot, so we had one less week than usual. So it is a, you know, still it's a little tighter than we usually are.
Yeah.
But we usually we're on the long side, and now we're kind of in line with what you would expect. So it's a little weird. It's still plenty of time, of course, but
well, we have at least double the technical rehearsal time that most companies have.
Exactly.
Which is plenty of time to cement things.
Yes.
But that only works if your stage director knows what they're doing in the first place.
Right.
If the stage director is still uncertain of what's going to happen next when you get into the theater, it doesn't matter how many days you have in the theater.
Right, yeah, that's not good.
Because every time you come in to rehearse, it's different than it was yesterday, so you can never get it cemented.
Exactly. Nope, it has to be repeatable. That's something about the theater. We don't try to eliminate any of the variables that you can, because things get crazy up there. I mean, it's you know, we're all professional people. We do a great job, but, you know, it's a daunting task going out in front of 1,200 people.
And working from memory, all that.
And working from memory and trying to coordinate with 40 people down below you and one person leading the whole thing and the rest of the people on stage, having a relationship with them and making sure you're singing out to the audience. That's like, if it's not a repeatable process that you're doing out there, good luck to you. It's been more challenge than I need in my life.
It's a little different from improv theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's so meticulously organized, every beat. That's another thing that's miraculous, are the complex skill sets of opera singers, that they really are able to move inside a moving matrix. They're able to go along through this sound, through time, and always be at the same place at the same time, mindful of so many different things that they have to be aware of.
Yeah.
That's why it's baby steps. That's why we always do things in little steps. So we don't ever send somebody out, at least we never have, knock on wood,
right,
just thrown into this thing with suddenly makeup to worry about, hair to worry about, hats to worry about, clothes to worry about.
Nope.
Where they're physically on the stage, following the conductor, hearing the orchestra, finding your pitches, just thrown in to have to do that all at one time. No, we bring people very slowly.
Yeah,
that's why our covers get so much rehearsal.
Yeah, the people listening might not know kind of how we do it. At least here, we start with music rehearsals for a week. We have a sing-through of the opera. Then we start staging, and we'll wear rehearsal costumes, shoes, that kind of thing, to just get an idea. It's not what we're going to wear on stage, but it's at least an approximation of that. So we know if we're on and off with a coat, if we have some business with our cuffs or our gloves or our hats, we know what's going on there. Then we move to the theater, and we do techs on stage, where we work with our props, and we play still with piano, but are up on stage with lights, more or less with lights, with the conductor in the pit. And then we have a Zitzprobe with the orchestra, where we're just singing with the orchestra for the first day. And then finally, and we have even a piano dress,
yeah,
even before that.
We introduced costumes.
Costumes even before the orchestra.
Then we introduce wigs.
Right, all of those things.
And then we introduce the orchestra, and then we introduce the orchestra with the costumes and wigs.
Right.
And action. So it's putting it together step by step by step. Of course, this was begun by Irene Dallas, because she intended this to be a place for young singers to actually figure out how to put a role together. She wasn't planning to teach them how to do it. She was just giving it to them in small enough bites that by the time the role was together, they could surprise themselves that they'd done it. So it's a very carefully graded thing. And many stage directors want to come and work here, but they don't want to spend the whole time, because most places they just get 2 weeks of staging rehearsals, 1 week of tech rehearsals, and you open. And I don't do that. Opera San Jose has never done that. And they try to talk me into it, and I won't budge. I'm never going to do it. I want 3 weeks of staging rehearsals. I want a minimum of 18 staging rehearsals. I'd like 21 when I can get them. And I like one whole week of music rehearsals.
Yeah, that's really nice at the beginning. And it's always with a, you know, some coach, master coach from San Francisco or, you know, from somewhere else that'll come and work with us that has experience with that opera. Those are very, very useful sessions in that first week.
And that's why we can have a 27-year-old singer on the stage who's really singing his first long role in his life.
Yeah.
As Colin just did in Lucia.
Right.
And have a brilliant success.
Exactly.
Never, ever deer in the headlights.
No.
He knows exactly, step by step. It's introduced in little bite-sized pieces. So by the time you're finished, you've eaten the whole cake, and you didn't know.
And that's how we do opera. Hope you were taking notes.
And if you're a director of an opera company somewhere, I hope you're over the laughter now. Because most companies just wouldn't even begin to think to keep people in town that long and try to do it that way. Because it's much faster if you only hire people who've already done the role somewhere else.
Yeah, fast is overrated.
I would go with that.
Yeah.
Fast is overrated.
Right.
Long, slow courtship, and then you meet the public. Well, there it is. Well, how have you been enjoying your stay at Opera San Jose? You're about to say goodbye.
It's been a wonderful time. I mean, you know, having that family that we've already talked about, you know, my wife, my two kids, my dog, and you know, in this business where a lot of the time is spent on the road, generally, that is not the case at Opera San Jose because of, you know, the way they operate, the way we operate here with our resident company. You get to put down roots, so to speak. You know, not permanent, of course, but even a year together when you're an opera singer is a luxury that is almost unheard of. So having been here for 3 years, being able to see my children grow up while we've been here, wonderful. I didn't have to go on any gigs away. I think I've probably spent maybe 4 or 5 nights away from my family in 3 years while I've been here.
Wow, so, that's a miracle for a singer.
I mean, and it's just like overnight trips to New York for an audition or something, and very, very minimal. And it can't be overstated how important that is. I mean, a lot of people take that for granted. If you're an accountant or if you're, you know, a banker and you just go to your job every day.
And you wish you were on a plane going somewhere else.
Well, yeah, that is the case. But, you know, there are benefits, of course. The grass is always greener, I suppose.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have you on our stage.
Thank you.
You have been a marvelous colleague, a wonderful employee.
Thank you.
And one of the most caring and committed people I've known. And I'm great. Really happy to have had you here. And, of course, we'll be calling you for things in the future.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
Okay.
Bye-bye.